Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with Tom Salta, who's in my studio, which is fantastic. And Tom, it's great to have a chance to talk with you.
Hi, Kate. It's great to be back. This is a beautiful studio you have.
I'm really excited to talk with you about your soundtrack for Wolfenstein Youngblood. It must be just like a dream job for you, because I know how much you love music from the 80s and that whole culture, and the game is set in the 80s, so it must have been a really fun project to work on.
Oh, yes. You can't believe how excited I was when I got the briefing, you know, because I heard about Wolfenstein, but then when I heard it was like going to be a 1981 period piece, so to speak, I was thrilled. And then as we dug in more into what the audio director was looking for, he really had a very specific part of the early 80s that he wanted it to sound like. It wasn't just, you know, new wave, you know, shiny, happy synthesizer stuff. It was very post-apocalyptic, dark, dismal, early 80s. I won't say dark wave, but more post-punk. Like Cocteau Twins.
Right.
More specifically, more like Graceland's album, Cocteau Twins. And I actually wasn't really familiar with that, because I was too busy listening to Yaz and Depeche Mode and Erasure. But then it took me on this rabbit hole journey when I started digging in during my, you know, R&D phase.
Yeah.
And I loved it. I was like, oh, this is going to be so much fun.
Yeah, that kind of grungy sound. I mean, in the whole world that the studio built is totally like what you would imagine the 80s would have been like if the Nazis were still around.
Well, thank you. I'll take that as a big compliment. That was what I was trying to imagine. Oh, man.
Yeah, it's a really sort of interesting vertical slice of that era and that time. And I had such a great time watching your TEDx talk about you getting your start with music and games. And there's a great photo of you with your very first Roland keyboard. And,
oh, yes.
And then how the studio, your home studio, got bigger and bigger and bigger. And so clearly this is just a bunch of equipment and a style of composing that you've been living with for a really long time.
Very much so. I was, I really started in the 80s, literally. I got my first keyboard, Roland JX3P, in 1985. And I fell in love with synth music before that. And that's what put the bug in me. And I begged my dad. It was the summer after eighth grade. And he finally broke down, and we went into New York City, and he got me the floor model, a used floor model of the Roland JX3P, because those things were darn expensive, and I really wanted the Juno 106, because that's the first one I ever heard at a friend's house. And I remember the day, I still remember it vividly, where I walked into his room and he had this thing, you know, because I grew up playing piano.
Right.
My mom taught me from when I was five. And so imagine this eighth grader, and I see this thing with buttons and lights, and it was a Juno 106. And I hit the key, and I heard this tone come out, and I'm like, oh my God, this is so cool. You know, this sounds like Depeche Mode, or this sounds like, and forget about it. I became obsessed with it from that point on. So I just loved synthesizers, and I loved copying what I heard, and I love all the effects and the technology that was available in the 80s when it came to music. And so really that took over my life. It was that and video games. That's to say, basically that was my life in 1985.
That's so cool. And so, yeah, if you draw a Venn diagram, there's all that middle ground, which is really, really
yes.
cool. You know, I've talked with other composers about this, but what is it about those early synths and early keyboards from the 80s that new ones just don't have?
Right. Well, you know, that's a great question. And the first thing that came into mind as you asked me that was, you can ask the same question about what was it about those early video games in the 1980s that had a special something that the ones today just don't have. And so it's, you know, you look at Pac-Man and you look at Galaga and you look at, you know, the things that started it all. So the synths in those days just, they focused on, they had a lot less to work with. Sounds familiar, right? Mm-hmm. Sounds like the video games in those days. The technology wasn't there. So the sounds themselves on synthesizers were generated off of analog, you know, circuits. And so they put all this time into the circuitry that had a certain sound, and the filters and the, you know, I'm not an electrical engineer, but if you open one of those things up, it's just analog circuits. There's nothing digital whatsoever about it. And they just had a sound and they had a personality.
Oh.
Just kind of like, again, you compare it to, let's say, video game companies. Like Namco Games had a personality, whereas Atari Games had a different personality, you know, even in the arcade. And I think that's what it was, like the Prophet. It just had a thing. It's like you hit the key and you knew it was a Prophet or an Oberheim or Roland. It's like these were the founding synths that everything is built from. And it's still the sounds of those things is still in fashion. It's just that they have evolved and become more complex and layered. And but still today, it's like the 80s are back in fashion in a big way. I mean, look at Stranger Things, right?
Right?
Look
yeah.
at... Well, Wolfenstein, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, just there's so much of the good part of the 80s that's coming back. And I think those synths are a big part of it. But now you don't have to buy the hardware. You can get the virtual plugins of that stuff.
Yeah,
which almost sounds as good.
Well, I think it's so funny because, you know, in the classical music world, period music is like the Baroque and before the classical era. And here we are
right.
kind of talking about period music from the 1980s.
That's right. Well, you see, in the 1980s.
So how much of your original equipment do you still have that you were able to use on this soundtrack?
Well, that's a very good question. Well, I'm going to split that into two. I have some of my favorite pieces still, like the Juno 106, which supposedly belonged to the Pet Shop Boys,
wow.
which is really cool, and my JX3P. But quite honestly, I don't use them much as far as generating sounds because it's just too inconvenient with all the other things that I have, whether it's plugins, and I also have some more modern synths, you know, because a lot of that old gear doesn't, you know, this key doesn't work mm-hmm. or this is too noisy. And, you know, I can get back into it, but unless it can do something better sounding than what I can do right now, I'm not going to use it. So for me, it's like my feel-good wall. I have a wall of keyboards from floor to ceiling that is like my museum of keyboards. I won't sell because it brings me more happiness just looking at it.
Oh, yeah.
But I have a Mini Moog, which I use quite a lot, and also a Prophet, which is more of a modern take on the original Prophet, and that just sounded gorgeous. So as far as hardware, I was using stuff like that. And it was still, so it's still very 80s authentic. And I would run it through 80s preamps and 80s reverbs. And so every part of the signal chain was authentic, whether it was a recreation or, you know, or the real thing.
Well, that's just so cool because it seems like for many of the composers that I talk with, setting limits is like the first step to mm-hmm. getting to what the music is going to sound like. And I think it's so cool that you set your limits with nothing that wasn't available in the 1980s.
Isn't that counterintuitive how setting limits actually gives you more freedom?
Yeah, yeah, for
it
sure.
It really does.
So the characters in Wolfenstein Youngblood, the twin daughters of William Blazkowicz, are looking for him in mm-hmm. Paris in the 1980s. He's
right.
just vanished. And mm-hmm. I think that's a great reason for the game to be set in the 80s.
Yeah.
And so what were the early discussions like about, you know, you working with their characters or some of their qualities that maybe you were able to bring out with your music?
Well, I'll tell you, there is a lot of very specific information that the audio director wanted me to work with. And fortunately, it didn't leave too much to chance where he wanted me to interpret a lot of the characters per se. He kind of laid it out. Really, the central sound for him was really the guitar mm-hmm. of like the Cocteau Twins and that post-punk era. And so I had a lot of discussions with him about that and analyzing the sound and trying to find how it could work in the context of the game, because there's really not much about that particular album that you could just transplant in the game and it would work for all the things that you have to do in Wolfenstein music, fights, exploration, things like
yeah.
that. So what I worked with him to and experimented, and we started with the guitars, and I actually crafted a tone that oftentimes I didn't even use a guitar, a real guitar. I used either a sample guitar or I used synthesizers that when run through certain effects sounded just like a guitar or something very close to it where it just has a unique sound. And I was so happy when I found that because for me, it's always about getting that signature sound. Mm-hmm. And especially if you have something like Wolfenstein that's an established franchise, you have fans who are very deep into this. I wanted to make sure that I would hit all the necessities, all those touch points. It has to be Wolfenstein, but it also has to be an era that we never covered in mm-hmm. Wolfenstein and a sound we've never covered. But it still has to feel like the game. And we have to do something we haven't done before. So anyway, all of those factors together, I think that's where it really came from. But it wasn't so much about me figuring out the personalities. It just came natural. When I watched all the cutscenes, I immediately saw their personalities, you know. They were just really spunky and, you know, very hard.
And it's super interesting because in that very first mission that they go on, when they get to Paris, you can tell they're a little bit tentative about it because they haven't really done this sort of Nazi hunting before. Yeah. And they get more and more confident, which is just, it's really, really cool.
Especially one key moment there was, I remember, it was haunting. I think I've just naturally resonated with it. I think it was a great choice to go with that sound, with that 80s era. But then I started to kind of blend it, and it evolved kind of like them, I guess you'd say. You know, there was certainly some of the music that I did which got really nasty and very harsh. And some of it was more flowy and smooth and dreamy,
yeah,
which is a big part of the sound that he liked, the audio director liked. He liked a lot of those twirly, swirly, floaty, kind of hallucinogenic guitar sounds. And it was kind of disorienting and interesting. I don't know. It has a very unique sound, I think.
Yeah, it really does. The track that you've put on SoundCloud for now, Paris 1980,
yeah,
has just this really cool wash of sound and so many layers.
Yeah.
And that made me wonder, you know, how is writing electronic music different from writing music for like acoustic instruments?
You know, I don't really look at it too much differently compositionally. I think I just have a lot of fun when I have electronic instruments or synthesizers, because it's just like having a bigger palette.
Mm-hmm.
When you're dealing with acoustic instruments, especially if you're not really recording real acoustic instruments, you often have to make sure that what you're doing is realistic.
Right, yeah.
And
that
sounds
they can play it.
Natural. It can be played. Is it true to the part? Is it true to the instrument? Is it going to sound... You know, whereas if you go into the world of synthesizers and electronics, the rules just go away. And I can just turn the knob on a synth or find a patch or create a new one. And I'm like, that just sounds cool. And let's just go with that. You know, there are no rules. It's really a lot more of a kid in the sandbox mentality. And quite frankly, since I come from that anyway, that's really my background. That bleeds into my music anyway, even when I'm doing acoustic or orchestral music. I'm really not so much concerned about what you're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. I'm more interested in what it sounds like.
How much time did you have to work on the soundtrack?
I had more time than I needed, and that was really due to the game development schedule. So I don't know. I'm thinking it was about 2 or 3 months, perhaps.
Wow.
But, you know, part of that was sometimes waiting. You know, sometimes a week would go by, and I'd be waiting to either get some feedback or waiting for the next assignment or some cutscenes or whatever it was. So I'd say it was a very comfortable schedule. I didn't feel like, oh, I ran out of time, and, you know. So that allowed me a lot of time to experiment and make sure that I had the sound that we all wanted.
Yeah, and you collaborated with Martin Stig Anderson.
Yes.
Which it must have been a really, really great experience.
Well, it was really nice, and Martin's such a wonderful person. I was very familiar with his work from Limbo, mm-hmm. and Inside, and I just love his approach to those. He's I guess you'd say he's known for a lot of that kind of ambient, hypnotizing, mm-hmm. drony sound design that evolves. And, of course, he worked on the last Wolfenstein game with Mick Gordon, and he did much of the same. So when I was working with him on this time, the audio director basically split up the composing duties into two different boxes. One was the Martin box and one was the Tom box. And so Martin was doing much of what he did on the past, which I guess fits into a similar description where it was much more sustained, perhaps ambient sounding, evolving sound design, experimentation. And that's awesome. And then I got assigned things that were very different. Things that perhaps had a lot of, you know, melodies or motifs or riffs or grooves or, you know, and synthesizer stuff, and things like that. So, and it was nice. And, you know, we had a very good working relationship, even though we weren't literally collaborating on the same music. I thought, and the audio director and Martin agreed, that we should stay in communication with each other during the process. And we would check in once in a while. How's it going? Hey, you know, just here's some of the things I just did this week. If you like anything, or if you want to borrow any of the content from it to kind of use, by all means. So I ended up sending him some of my pieces and stems so that he could, you know, maybe work with some of it and have fun. So that's kind of what it was. So like we had our own independence, mm-hmm. and we had a nice collaborative relationship where we were not stepping on each other's toes.
That's really cool. And it sounds like that bit of idea sharing too was really great, because then it sounds like there's a cohesive quality
to the
soundtrack.
It's very important. I've always get a little skittish when I hear that they're going to have multiple composers on a project. Mm-hmm. I'm still of the mind that there, when it comes to a musical identity, there should be one mind.
Right.
And, you know, and then you can have other people perhaps collaborating, but I think it should start from a central place. In this case, I'm glad that we had an audio director who was able to fill that role.
Yeah.
So he was able to kind of keep us reined in, and and also with our good communication directly with Martin, you know, sometimes composers get a little, you know, I guess competitive and secretive, and they're like, no, I'm going to, it becomes this competition, and I don't like working that way, and I know Martin doesn't either. So it was a very nice, cohesive, pleasant experience.
Yeah, it sounds like it was a good choice to put you two together.
Yeah. I love doing that. I like that process.
Well, you mentioned beats, and one of the tracks that I really enjoyed was Enter the Siegturm, because that battle is so amazing. And what I noticed was you can, if you time it right, you can fire your gun and it like matches the tempo of the song. It's just so amazing. So.
Oh, thank you. I admire the nuances that you pick up on. Yes, that was not an accident. I don't know about the timing. I certainly didn't adjust the tempo to fit the timing, but I did want to imitate the automatic, you know, things like that. And how to do it, though, in an 80s vocabulary was a little bit more of a fun challenge, let's put it that way. in the 80s, when I was growing up in the 80s, even in the mid 80s, I was just dealing with drum machines.
Yeah, and, I was going to say.
And in 1980, I wasn't dealing, there was no digital drum machine. So it was all, you know, natural acoustic created, you know, like the 808 and the 909 and the DMX, the Oberheim DMX. That was one of the ones that I kind of used. And, you know, one of the tricks of getting that 80s sound isn't just by going back to the sound source and playing it. In the 80s, they didn't just take a synth or a drum machine and record it. They would put it through stuff. They would put it through effects. And there would be a lot of things and layers to make it sound the way it is. Because, quite frankly, a lot of the sounds were boring. You know, they're very plain.
Yeah.
You know, just like if you listen to 8-bit music. It's very plain and simple, you know, mm-hmm. simple waveforms. So, you know, with the drums and stuff in Wolfenstein, I'm glad that we kind of figured out a way to have something that was satisfying, because that was my concern. It's like, no one's going to care if you were accurate if it doesn't sound cool.
Right, yeah.
Well, I decided, who cares, dude? You know, it sounds way better to do it this way. So I wanted to make sure that I could make it as satisfying as possible. So, you know, I beefed it up. I cranked them through a lot of preamps. I layered them. I EQ'd. I put them through different effects and certain kind of 80s reverbs that were used to give it space. I, you know, all kinds of tricks and things that I was doing almost 30 years ago. Well, wow. Actually 30 years ago. Yeah.
Well, yeah, because, you know, when you were living through it, I mean, obviously you were paying attention to what you were doing then, but right. I'm wondering if you had to, like, go back and sort of analyze and reverse engineer some of those sounds that you really liked.
Yeah, and I like it because, again, it goes back to that discussion on limits. It's like, mm-hmm. okay, well, if I wanted to make this wide in 1981, what would I do? It's like, well, I don't have many choices. I'd have to either use a chorus, you know, or I would use the Roland, I forgot what the digits are. But anyway, it was this piece, this rack with four buttons and it had four choruses. It was very much like the chorus in the Juno 106. And you'd run it through that and that's the sound. It's like, that's what you did, you know, or you use a Lexicon 480 and you got a little creative with that, you know, so it was fun. It was an excuse to go into a sandbox that was very reminiscent for me, you know, not having to be like worried to have to be cool and using all the latest, you know, newest thing. I could go back to what I was familiar with back in those early days and it was comforting in a way.
Yeah, well, like,
I had a lot of fun, in case you couldn't tell.
Like, you know, driving your favorite car from the mid-80s.
Absolutely. In fact, I have a 1984 Porsche 944, and that's just, you know, I was in seventh grade. That was, I didn't have it back then, you know, but it's, there's something about it. It's just brings you back, and it gives you that feel-good feeling.
Yeah, right? For sure. And the throwback, I mean, it even extends to the title, the end title song, because you got to work with The Gilt. And yes. I thought it was cool. In your lecture, you mentioned that you always wanted to be a record producer.
Yes.
So here you got a chance to do that because they did a great cover of A Means to an End.
Yes, yes. So that was very, very interesting, you know. So A Means to an End is a Joy Division song. And I encourage, if you're listening to this, go and listen to the original of Means to an End by Joy Division.
I did, and I like The Gilt's version a whole lot better.
Nothing against Joy Division, but that was a very interesting approach. Mm-hmm. I mean, he sounded like he just woke up and had a really long, bad night. Singing that. It was very slow. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, when the audio director said A Means to an End, I'm like, of all the Joy Division songs, that's the one? And he's like, well, you know, the thing is the lyrics really spoke to the characters. And that's why we wanted it. I said, okay, so if it's really about the lyrics, then we can take some liberties when it comes to the production. We can reinterpret it. He's like, oh, yes, by all means. So when they played me, they were fans of The Gilt. That's how this came apart. The folks in Sweden at the development studio, the Machine Games, love The Gilt. They're just fans. So they're like, well, we want to work with The Gilt. I'm like, oh, great. I'm happy to produce them. Let's do it. Like, we want to do that song. So I listened to it. They listened to it. We spoke on Skype a few times, and we're like, yeah, that song, is that's, what are we going to do with that? So when I heard their music, they had this song called Anomalous or whatever. You go on YouTube. It is crazy hard. I mean, it's like, I'd almost say like Marilyn Manson kind of, but a punk version. they're an electropunk band, and you know, I'm like, ooh, you know, like I could tell that's where they were. That's where that their minds were at, that kind of aggression. So I'm like, ooh, why don't we take, instead of this, you know, it's like, why don't we go, you know? And they're like, yeah, let's do it. So then I just kind of worked up a first rough sketch of it in the tempo, and I sent it over. And they're like, yes, we like it. And I played as the director, and he liked it too. So that's where it started. And so I put together the basic track. I handed it over to them. They layered in. Of course, Emma did a great job with vocals. We went back and forth many times because she had to get really familiar with the song. She wasn't feeling it at first. She had to sing it like 5 times before she herself was even happy.
Well, because it's a second language, too.
It's so, a second language, and it's a huge leap going from that original to where it ended up. So she had to really own it, like she's been singing it for a long time.
Yeah.
So that's what happened. And by the end, I think it came out. It was a lot of fun, and that's what you hear in the end credits, and have it on my SoundCloud.
So cool, because it's like, wait, there aren't any more Nazis to kill? I mean, it's because they're so pumped up by the end by the end of the game.
Yes, and it was an excuse to break out my mini Moog doing the bass line. I just love that stuff. I was all like, oh, it's heaven.
Yeah. We've mentioned your SoundCloud stream, and there are some tracks on there. Are you going to release more of the tracks?
Yes. Well, I do plan on going back and remastering, remixing more and more music from the game. I wish I could tell you that there are plans from the publisher, Bethesda, to release a soundtrack of this. Currently, there are not. But I do encourage everyone who would be interested to please let them know if you'd like to hear the soundtrack, because there's a lot of fun, good stuff in there, and I'd hate to not let it get beyond just the confines of the game itself.
Well, especially because now, you know, game soundtracks are such an integral part of a game's release,
yeah,
and there's such a huge fan base for them.
Sure.
And so
it helps it live on, and it extends the enjoyment factor, you know, for players. It's like, oh, I love that. And my goodness, a lot of people just listen to video game music in the background while they're driving or while they're creating or whether they're doing homework or whatever. There's something about video game music. It actually encourages concentration, quite frankly, because it's designed to help you focus on one thing, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, it's just, I hope they do release it. But if they don't, stay tuned. I will be posting more and more music to my website and to my SoundCloud.
Yeah, that's awesome. And this isn't the end of the road for Wolfenstein for you either, because there's a VR game that's in the works too.
That was actually, it got released already. It was on the same day, and it was called Wolfenstein Cyberpilot. Mm-hmm. So it's on, I believe it's on PlayStation VR, it's on Vive, and it's Oculus Rift. I think that's all, but I'm not sure. And it's a lot of fun. I have the Vive, so I was playing it. It was really cool. I'm like, okay, this is very satisfying because you're riding on the top of one of those mechanical dog robot things, and you just got a big flamethrower, and you're just killing Nazis. It's so
How
satisfying.
How could that not be fun, right?
It's like when, in the 80s, that was my dream. Like, if you could go in the game and become the game. That's what Tron was all about. That was a fantasy of all of us in the 80s. Can you go in the game? And now you can. So I highly recommend it. And they used a lot of the same music from Youngblood, but they also asked me to compose some custom, unique music just for Cyberpilot. And it's used toward the end of the game when you're approaching, I guess, the ending boss and stuff like that.
Yeah,
so I'd say if you have the technology, check it out.
That is so cool. Did you work at all with 3D audio for, you know, since it's a VR experience?
Or? Yeah. No, I didn't. That's a really good question. I didn't work with three-dimensional audio per se. I worked with stereo, but since when you play VR, you have headphones on.
Mm-hmm.
I made sure that when I was doing that music, and particularly when I was coming towards the mixing phase and finalizing, that I did wear headphones the whole time.
Wow.
Because that enabled me to do things that you couldn't do or you wouldn't appreciate if you were just basing it on a TV or a stereo set of speakers.
Right.
So if you listen to Cyberpilot, I do encourage you to put headphones on and listen to that music with the headphones, because I was able to do some, and I did do pseudo 3D. There was some gear, I believe it was from the 80s, called the Cyclosonic Panner. Cyclosonic, I think it was. And it did some cool phasing and things like that that gave the illusion of height and gave the illusion that it was going in a circle rather than just to the two sides of your head.
That's so
and
cool.
So I used that quite a bit in there because you had the headphones on.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So, wow, it has been so much fun to talk with you. And I didn't think I was nostalgic for the 80s until I started listening to this music. So thank you for that.
Well, you're very welcome.
And Tom, thanks again for making the trip up here. It's really been fun.
Oh, thanks for having me. Anytime.